This is Audible.
Day Street Harper Audio present. Fail until you don't. Fight, grind, repeat. By me, Bobby Bones. This is the author. And now for my book dedication. To my dog, Dusty. Sadly, you'll never get to read this. Mostly because you didn't know how to read because you were a dog. Rest in peace, buddy. 2003 to 2018. Introduction. Fight, grind, repeat, or your motivational guide to being less terrible at life. When I decided to write another book, even though I didn't know if I had another chapter in me, let alone a whole other book in me, I wanted to write How to Face Your Fears. I figured I'd describe a lot of the fears I've felt in my life and how I face them all, like the superhero that I am. But to be honest, that would be a load of crap, and my fans are quick to smell the BS. It's also weird to call my people fans. I mean, when I think of fans, I picture a Green Bay Packers diehard with face paint and no shirt, fighting the elements in sub-zero temperatures. Like, that's a fan. My people aren't fanatical about me. They understand me, or at least they can stomach me for relatively large amounts of time. And that's all I really need, and I appreciate that. So instead of hitting you with a fake, face your fears, it's amazing type read, I'm going to tell you a story. A story about when I faced my biggest fear. And when I wrote this, I wrote it just a few hours after it actually happened. So basically, it's the book version of an NFL instant replay, except not so instant, because you're listening to this months after it happened. These books take forever to get published. But just rest assured that when I wrote it the first time, it was right after it happened. The details still fresh in my brain as I sit here in the Little Rock Airport, a very familiar and comfortable setting. I'm surrounded by the nice folks decked out in Arkansas Razorbacks hats and t-shirts, which I love. About 10 people have already stopped to tell me that they listen to my radio show. I appreciate when anyone stops me to say they listen to my morning show that I've been doing in some shape or form for nearly 20 years. Man, I'm getting old. I mean, I know I started at 17, but 20 years? So my career is basically as old as some of the girls I've considered dating. I mean, 20 is too young for me. I mean, they can't even get into a casino, but I'll start taking rejections at age 25 or so. Although my morning show is nationally syndicated, it's always cool when someone from where you grew up say they listen. It's especially sweet in Arkansas, which is my first home, with Austin and Nashville coming in second and third. Despite all that good stuff, my cage is definitely a little rattled right now. Mostly because of that fear that I mentioned earlier. You know that one where I debated openly if I'd still date a college sophomore? To reiterate, I don't think I would. Before I reveal this mysterious fear, a little backstory. So you know all about this if you read or you listened to my memoir, or however you say memoir. Bare Bones by Bobby Bones. That's me. That's the book. Or if you've listened to my radio show where I talk a lot about myself. Or have stood within 20 feet of me in the last 100 months. But in case you don't fit into any of those categories, here's a quick version for you. I don't know my biological father. I mean, I know who he is. Like his name, where he comes from. It's the same place that I come from. I mean, not the same vagina. That would make him my brother dad if we came from the same vagina. And if that were the case, for sure, I'd have a reality show on TLC right now. But that's about it as far as what I know about him. This stranger, otherwise known as my dad, left my mom and me around the time that my memories really started to be formed. So I have only fleeting impressions of him here and there, but no full-on memories. No ball playing, no whoopings, no you'll eventually get girls to like you, or you can't date that many girls at once. By the way, Amy, my co-host, and the moral compass of my show sets me straight on that one. So yeah, I don't know my dad. He's never been part of my life. It's sad. So sad that I decided to turn it into a joke in my stand-up act. And this is a joke. It's called The Saddest Joke I've Ever Written. And you have to imagine me. I'm on a stage and there are a couple thousand people watching and I've been making people laugh through the last 45 minutes or so. And I say that this is the saddest joke I've ever written. So I was on Facebook yesterday and I was looking at the tab that says people you may know, and my biological father popped up. I didn't. And then people sit there awkwardly. Then I follow it up with this joke here. I say, I'd like to now do an impression of my biological father. And then I walk off stage. In my mind, the joke was a real hit, even though it confused the audience because they didn't know whether to laugh or groan or feel sad. But I love that. I love creating any sort of emotion. I love to make people confused. I love to make them question if they're supposed to laugh. Just to make people feel, that's what I love to do, which often means taking them out of their comfort zone. Jokes aside, when it comes to not having a dad, I have been sad, angry, resentful, apathetic, and then sad again. That's a cycle I've repeated for about the last 30 years of my life. And as I was thinking of the scariest things I've ever done, you know, for a relatable and engaging anecdote to open my new book, I felt like it would be hypocritical not to describe my biggest fear. And that is meeting the person I've turned into the ultimate villain in my mind, my dad. I let my anger and I let my fear keep me from ever reaching out to him. I thought I was punishing him for not being around when I was a kid. In reality, I was punishing myself. It wasn't until I started thinking of these central ideas of what I wanted this book to be about that I finally felt I had to take that polar plunge, which, by the way, the polar plunge, that's the stupid group of people who jump in the water in January because they say it's so invigorating. But most of the time, I think they just end up with pneumonia. And although I might have been subconsciously looking for any reason to reach out to my dad, I decided to reach out after all these years because I didn't want to feel like a hypocrite when I wrote about all the positive results that could come from facing your fear. And this entire adventure started with a text to my cousin Mary asking, hey, do you have Mike's number? Mike, that's the name of my dad. And she did. So, well, crap. Now I had to reach out. Again, if I wanted to lecture you about chasing your biggest fear, you would come back to me about why I hadn't done mine. So I was in it to win it. Or as they say on the streets, I was in it because I was writing a book about failure and didn't want the whole thing to be a farce. Okay, so maybe that's not the best street lingo, but you get it. So I texted him. I said, hey, it's Bobby Estill. That's what I said. I'm thinking that if I just wrote, hey, it's Bobby, he probably wouldn't know who that was. I nearly texted, hey, it's your long lost son, Bobby. But I didn't know if he'd get the sarcasm or even think that was funny. I said, I'm going to be in town and I want to know if we can meet up. And then I waited for a text back. 1 hour, nothing. 2 hours, nothing. I assumed he wasn't like me, the guy who keeps his phone in his hand the entire day. But it was still nerve-wracking to not get a text back after a few hours. I mean, I had really put myself out there sending that message. The least I would expect was an answer, even if the answer was, nah. I was traveling that day, so I didn't have a lot to do except stare at my phone, which made time drag by even slower, and it made my anxiety ramp up even more. I began to think he wasn't going to text me back at all. Rejected again. But finally, after 4 hours and 23 minutes later, but who's counting, right? I got that text. That sounds good. Let me know. What did that mean? Sounds good? And let me know? And why did he take 4 hours to get back to me? Was he on a job site? Was he getting an MRI? Was he trapped in a well? Or did it actually sound not good to him? I don't know what I was expecting, really, for him to write back, wow, 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 smiley face, glad to hear from you. I've been meaning to text you for the last 30 years, but I couldn't find your number, smiley face. Nah. But still, over the next few days, I distanced myself from my nagging doubts, and if there were an Olympic sport and compartmentalizing emotions, I'd take down Muhammad Ali or Michael Phelps as being the greatest of all time. Right then, I separated myself from it. Bam. Much like the Tide Pod Challenge, I acted like I didn't want to go through with it, but secretly, I wanted to see what all the fuss was about. Both meeting my dad and eating Tide Pods. By the way, what are people thinking eating those small packets of washing detergent? And by people, I mean adults who are smart enough to put videos on YouTube. There's no reason we need to do PSAs for 23-year-old internet attention whores who choose to eat soap. For moms with babies, I get it. Hey, new moms, watch out the little Katie doesn't eat these little packets because they do look like candy. But for adults to have to learn that news, don't eat detergent because you can die. They already know that. To report the obvious is to do nothing but compel fools to continue eating the clothes cleaning poison. That's right. I blame you, the Today Show. Sorry, got a little loud there, but right now, as I'm doing this book, I'm dealing with a lot of Tide Pod stories. But onward with the story. The trip to see my father became just a date on the calendar to me. I booked my flight from Austin to Little Rock, and I just carried on with my life. Nothing to see here. Imagine me whistling after I say nothing to see here, like they do it on the movies, like, nothing to see here. That was me just playing it cool, right? It wasn't until I was on the flight to Little Rock that it thumped me in my ear. I was going to meet the man who helped bring me into this world, then disappeared over 30 years ago. And for all that time, hid in plain sight. He lived no more than a few miles from me for a lot of the time I was growing up. But for that story, you could read my first book. One of my favorite creatures is the butterfly. Now, it's not my absolute favorite. That'd be a dog. With a koala coming in close second. I got to hold a koala in Australia. He didn't bite me or take a crap on me, so I was pretty pumped about that. After that, the koala shot up the favorites list very fast. But butterflies. I do love butterflies. I love the feeling of butterflies in your stomach that you get whenever you're nervous. We don't have a lot of times in our life when we get to be genuinely nervous about a potentially positive outcome. Being nervous is uncommon. It's uncomfortable. It's stressful. But that's why it's awesome. Being nervous is how I feel alive. To me, it's a rush. It's a mental bungee jump. On the plane to meet my dad, I wasn't nervous. At least not in the awesome way. I was overwhelmed with thoughts about where this whole thing was going. I wondered if my father was suspicious of my motives. I'm the one who has yelled on the radio and written a book that I was pissed about his sudden departure all those years ago. And yet, here I was, initiating contact by texting him out of the blue. What could he be imagining? That I wanted to beat him up? Or maybe be best friends? Or did I need a kidney? I was trying to get into his head more than I was worried about what was going on in my own head. This was no doubt an intellectual defense mechanism, because I knew that a few layers down, I was petrified. As soon as I landed in Arkansas, I texted him that we should meet for lunch the following day at a barbecue restaurant I had found online and chosen for its convenient location. I initially thought about meeting in a park or just on a bench somewhere, but then I reconsidered. That just felt weird. If someone who I hadn't seen in years told me to meet him in a park in the middle of the day, I would instantly assume it's because he wanted to jump me for money. Maybe to buy that new kidney I was talking about earlier. The next day at exactly noon, I drove into the parking lot of the barbecue joint and bam, there he was, sitting inside his truck. I knew it was him because I had seen a couple pictures of him over the years, and also I could just tell. He looked like me more than anyone else had ever met, or should I say I looked like him. Now, I had purposely showed up right on time in order to avoid this situation. I'd hoped he'd be early and inside waiting on me, not the opposite. This was now turning into a first date with a hot chick experience. Except instead of a hot chick, insert man who abandoned me 30 years ago. I turned off the gray Jeep Cherokee I had rented, got out, and walked directly into the restaurant. I didn't want to walk inside with him, because then who opens the door for who? I mean, pass on that situation. The awkward talk and walk side by side, that's awkward. I'll pass on that too. The barbecue place was the kind where you order from a counter, you get a number, you seat yourself, and then you wait for your food. I was looking up at the menu above the counter. He walked in, and he stood right behind me. He was wearing a blue work uniform, blue on blue, and extremely white tennis shoes. Let me commend his white shoes, by the way, because I know those were probably work shoes, and they were as clean as they could be. I got a pair of white Yeezys, and before I could get them out of the box, somehow, they had already looked like they were in a charcoal bath. White shoes are that hard to keep clean. So, I respected that. He also had on a camouflage ball cap on top of his long hair. With my dad too close to ignore and continue ordering, I turned to him and said, "Hey man, good to see you." And I reached out my hand to shake his, and I was thinking, please don't hug me, please don't hug me, please don't hug me. He didn't hug me. He shook my hand. He said it was good to see me too. We had a brief, uncomfortable conversation about what to eat. Luckily, I already knew what I wanted. I know what I want to eat before I get to a restaurant almost every time. I prepare for the menu as if it were a driving test, although I don't have to cheat with menus like I do driving tests. I've never not cheated the eyesight part of a driving test. You see, I can't see. I only have one eye that works. My right eye only sees light and fuzzy shapes. And when I look into that machine with that bad eye, I see nothing but a bright yellow stain mocking my inadequacy. If you Google the right things, you can memorize the current test. But I shall say no more, for fear of having my driver's license revoked. But yes, I'm always trying to game the system. So I put my order in, and I sat at the back of the restaurant. My dad was smaller than me. I liked that, because if things got ugly, I knew I could take him to beat downtown. Well, except for the small fact I've actually never punched anyone. Still, I liked that I was bigger. But then my brain started to draw these complex maps of the unknown terrain ahead. Meaning, what do I say first? Did I really just use the phrase, beat downtown? I'm such a loser. I decided to go with thanking him for taking off work to meet me. That's what I opened with. Then I asked the most important question first. I mean, sitting in front of me was someone who was supposed to be the most important man in my life, and I hadn't seen him in 30 years. Now was my chance to find out exactly what I wanted to know more than anything else. So I just went for it. I asked it straight up. I said, "Hey, will you pull your hat back? Do you still have all your hair?" He let out a nervous laugh and he pulled his hat back. "I've still got it all," he said. He wasn't bald or even losing his hair. As a matter of fact, he has lots and lots of it. He basically looks like everyone from Lynyrd Skynyrd, and that was awesome. I was grateful for that. Now, he may not have bought school supplies or taught me how to shave or awkwardly told me it was normal for men to play with themselves like that, but he did have good hair genes. And before you tell me, hair is all on your mom's side, that's BS. It's been proven a million times that it can come from either side or both. I have a lot of friends who are bald just like their dad. So, hair, check. The food came. I noticed his hand was shaking when he took a bite of the sandwich. And that was pretty much the only bite that he took. However nervous I felt on the plane yesterday, or even in the parking lot a few minutes earlier, it was clear that my dad was way more nervous. There was something about seeing how rattled he was that settled me down. See, when crazy situations arise, most of us fall into roles. Mine was the calm one. He hardly touched his food, but I was devouring mine. As I went through an entire rack of ribs, I had to bring me an extra plate for the bones, and I said, "More paper towels, please." We talked about what he does now. He works with my cousin Josh, who runs a roofing company, and about how he had been sober for a while. I told him, "I would really like to drink, but it doesn't seem to be a good spot for any of us with our genetics." And he agreed, and he urged me to stay away from it since I've gone this long without touching alcohol. We talked a lot about his horses. He said he gets back to his land whenever he can to make sure they're fed and taken care of. He's very prideful, he's very happy about that, and I was happy about that. I also wanted to talk about jail. See, a lot of my family's been to jail, and I wanted to know why. He told me he had only done a few rounds, and that was for really dumb stuff. You know, very small amounts of time. We talked about my cousin Derek, who made the national news a couple years earlier for escaping prison. I said, I could not believe that Derek was on Good Morning America. I told him the cops were calling me, asking if I knew anything about it. He said the same thing happened to him. I think they showed up at the house of pretty much every Yestel, that's me, my last name, to see if Derek was there. By the way, Google Derek Estel prison escape. That's my first cousin. I don't remember my dad asking me any questions. Part of me thinks that he listens to the show and hears things like this book, so he has a good idea of what's happening with me. Part of me thinks he was just too freaked out. And either way, I was okay, because being in his physical presence was enough. For once in my life, I just wanted to sit across from my dad and have a conversation, even if it was about nothing. And for 45 minutes, over lunch, I did. Yeah, sure, he'll never be my dad in the way most people use the word. But by not reaching out to him because I was scared of rejection, I wasn't giving either one of us a chance to change the story. As a defense mechanism, I had turned him into the Joker or Bane, you know, a supervillain out to destroy my life. By avoiding him, I had made him into something much larger than he actually was. Someone who screwed up a lot. Someone who was extremely flawed. Someone just like me. The end. Except not really. See, that was the perfect ending for this section. Dramatic, heart-wrenching, with just a hint of self-reflection. But I don't go down like that. Can I first say how awkward it was for me to write the word dad in reference to the man I had lunch with? I just got tired of writing the words biological father in every paragraph. I wouldn't call him dad to anyone, except for the fact that I'm a lazy writer. I also wouldn't call Kid Rock Bob. His name is Robert Ritchie, by the way. His friends call him Bob. I've spent some time with Kid Rock recently through work, and everyone keeps telling me to call him Bob. Even Kid Rock says, hey, call me Bob. I won't do it. I nod and say, you got it, Kid Rock. He will always be freaking Kid Rock to me. Yeah, I'm a huge dork, like I said earlier. The real end of the story with my, well, dad is a lot less dramatic. We've exchanged a few texts since that lunch, and I plan to reach out to him next time I'm home. I never thought we were going to turn into Andy Griffith and his son Opie. The greatest outcome from that lunch is that I will no longer not go home because he's around. This fairy tale ending is still growing its wings, and hopefully nobody dies. What I hope you take away from this is that sometimes we assign completely false narratives to stories because they make life easier to understand. I did. I imagined my real dad lying in bed at night, laughing like a maniac about how he had wronged his son. Ha 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 ha. That was totally false. He didn't like it any more than I did. But it was easier for me to believe that over the truth because it allowed me to make him the bad guy. The truth is, he's flawed. I'm flawed. And I hope people can understand and forgive me like I have my dad. How the heck is this a self-help book? Well, by now you're probably wondering how this depressing story about a deadbeat dad and his neurotic son is going to lead to self-improvement, right? I'll be honest. At first, I wasn't sure I wanted to write this book. I'm not a guy who looks for signs in the universe to tell him things. I believe that if you search hard enough for the answer you already know, you'll find it. As human beings, we generally follow an instinct, but still chase affirmation from something bigger than us to tell us that instinct is right. But I'm not a normal human being, and I'm not going to do that. I don't believe in luck. I don't believe in destiny. Instead, I believe that our lives are powered by countless micro decisions. Some dude found a $1 million lottery ticket on the sidewalk walking to work one day. Okay, that's luck, right? What if he hadn't gone to work? What if he hadn't chosen that sidewalk? What if he hadn't looked down at the ground? All of these are factors that we assign to luck. But I believe every single thing that happens to us, good or bad, is affected by decisions that we make. The title of this book should be a tip-off that it's not going to be some think positive thoughts to success kind of program. It's just not that. I always come to things from an underdog's point of view, and who am I to offer any kind of program anyways? My preferred place to start is from the bottom, where, as they say, you have nowhere to go but up. And when you start from the bottom and succeed, you always have a theme song. And right now is where if I could, if I legally owned it, I would play Drake's Start Up From The Bottom. The point of the lunch with my dad story isn't even that I had faced my biggest fear. For years and years, I had thought about meeting him, even at times obsessed over it, but I never, ever made a single attempt. As those years kept ticking by, the act of trying got bigger and it got harder. And so I had to turn my dad into a villain to explain my inaction. By giving the act of meeting my dad one legitimate, full-hearted try, I knew that no matter what happened, I wouldn't fail, at least not in the long run. In my book, both literally and figuratively, failing isn't bad. Oftentimes, people won't try things because they're afraid to fail. But my philosophy in life is about winning by losing. That might sound like a foreign concept, because the general rule is that if people are good at something, they win. But really, from all that I've learned, the biggest winners are also the biggest losers. And I definitely put myself in the biggest loser category. By the way, not to be confused with the TV show The Biggest Loser. The only episodes I've seen of that show are the ones where the contestants bust through the paper of their old selves and poof, they're 100 pounds lighter. That show makes losing 100 pounds look easy. Even though obviously it isn't. I'd like to equate the finale of The Biggest Loser with your life. Most people will just see you bust through the paper in whatever transformation you've made and think, oh, that was easy for you. But they don't know that you've been grinding on a treadmill for hours when the cameras were off. They don't know that you've been getting yelled at by Jillian Michaels for licking the plastic wrapping on a cookie a few too many times. They don't know that, but I do because I'm someone who has failed so often that eventually I learned something useful to break the cycle, and I plan to give you the information to turn heartbreak and failure into inspiration. I developed the strategies that I lay out in this book, including embracing failure, out of necessity. I had a dysfunctional upbringing that lacked any of the resources, financial or cultural, that people typically need to succeed. And yet, I had big dreams for myself. I wanted to do more than follow the example of my parents and peers in my small, poor, dying Arkansas town. I wanted to beat my very bad odds. And when you're trying to beat bad odds, you have to do more than what's expected, like going to college and working hard. A lot more. And you have to be your own champion. None of that's easy, which is why I came up with these strategies to help me along. But let me say, they weren't right the first or second or 93rd time I implemented them. And they continue to be partially wrong even today. I figured out that you never completely figure it out. And if that makes me sound like the Aristotle of Arkansas, then so be it. Everything in life is a moving target. I set absolute goals. For example, I'd like for my show to be heard in 100 cities, or to make this next romantic relationship last for more than 8 days. But regardless of the result, I learn from it and I keep going. Too many people in my life just blow in the wind and they change what they want as the weather picks up. I'm basically Jim Cantor from the Weather Channel. I stand out in the hurricane and I take it on to see what happens on the other side. Take, for instance, this Category 3 hurricane that just blew in today, conveniently, as my deadline arrived to commit to writing this next piece of literary genius. My latest inspiration in the winning by losing game came just 2 hours ago in the form of being rejected yet again for a television show. Now, if you haven't read my first book, by the way, it's called Bare Bones by Bobby Bones. In case you've already forgot, maybe you should check it out. I will give you a little backstory here. That book started with me auditioning for a TV show and ended many months later with me landing the part. Yes. But the network ultimately not picking the show up. No. And lots of stories, both happy and sad, in the middle of that. So here we are again. I got a note on another TV show. But at least you didn't have to wait a whole book to find out the ending. And it actually motivated me to start this book. So for your visual consideration right now, I'm sitting at a red desk wearing a pair of blue shorts, a fake vintage AC/DC t-shirt. Even though for the most part, I think these fake vintage shirts are so cornball. The problem that I have with fake vintage shirts is that people wear them to look way cooler than they really are. Someone with real style or passion for a vintage band or piece of clothing would have many options to find a legitimate, authentic band t-shirt, eBay, thrift shops, Etsy. But nah, instead we just find it at the mall or Target and we buy it. And then we Wikipedia just enough about the band or album in case anyone asks us about it. My light blue AC/DC shirt that I'm wearing right now says 1974 Jailbreak. I wasn't even born in 1974, so I'll admit to being a cornball, but I would like to establish a new rule about wearing musical t-shirts to simply look cool. If you're wearing an artist on your shirt and you don't know at least 5 of the artist's songs, when someone asks, you owe a $5 donation to the charity of that person's choice. With this new rule in place, either people will learn more about Merle Haggard or puppies will get fed. Either way, it's a win. So back to my latest rejection, which arrived in an email notifying me that a show I was executive producing had been turned down by a major network. This was one that I felt pretty sure was going to work, and I'm a pretty pessimistic person. It was about a couple of people in the country music world and their family life. It was nothing earth-shattering, but we weren't trying to be groundbreaking here. The finished product was warm, it was funny, it was not puke-inducingly fake. In reality show terms, that's the best you can hope for. The network's test audiences gave it great reviews, and even so, bam, nope. My response could have been to curl up in a ball and binge watch The Walking Dead, but I have a general rule. The bigger the disappointment, the harder I keep trying. A wise man once said, instead of crying, I keep on trying. And that wise man is me, because I just made that up, I think. Quote me on that, unless you see it in a meme somewhere where Billy Graham or Gandhi said it. Otherwise, yeah, I just made that up. I'm not going to give up or let this setback stop me from getting lots of TV shows on the air. By the way, right now, lots means one. So here I am, hours after being told no to yet another TV show, taking a few notes on what I've learned this time around, and bouncing back with the knowledge that if I keep trying and getting better at making television, something will actually work. And I'll win by losing. Now, I can imagine you may not be very inspired by this kind of advice from a guy like me. I'm no longer broke. I have radio's biggest country music morning show. I wrote a best-selling book. a front of band that's also had a number one record and a song, and here I am patting myself on the back for recovering after not getting a TV show. But also, if you knew where I came from, you might understand the power of my mindset and see how it's helped me get to where I am today. Like so many other people, I grew up with a lot of adversity and negativity. It would have been really easy to get overwhelmed and eventually give in. But by turning negatives into positives, losing into a journey to winning, I've been able to overcome the odds that were against me into motivation for my success. It's that mentality I hope to pass on in this book to others who are struggling. I was raised in the small town of Mountain Pine, Arkansas, population 700, and that's optimistic. Typical of a company mill town after the mill shuts down, it's an impoverished place. When I was growing up there, money wasn't a thing people missed because nobody had any of it. If you give a 16-year-old a BMW, take it away from him, and replace it with a Kia, he's probably going to be upset. We didn't even know BMWs existed. It was the same with options in life. Hardly anyone left Mountain Pine to pursue his or her own dreams. We didn't even know big dreams were allowed to happen. The folks who I grew up with, they weren't mad about that. We just knew our place, and we knew it because we saw it every day all around us. No one told us we were stuck, but no one told us we weren't either. Suffice to say, my hometown was not conducive for a kid's dreams of creating his own media empire. Yet, even within this poor community, I always felt that I was coming from a disadvantage. My mom, who struggled her entire life with alcohol and drug addiction, had a hard time holding down a job, often left me in the care of my grandma for long stretches. For years, I resented the fact that I was a food stamps kid, a head lice student, a connoisseur of the finest welfare checks. I hated it. I blamed everyone around me, and I loathed other kids with the flimsiest of safety nets, because I had none. I never saw this uncertainty for the strength that it actually gave me. It wasn't until much later that I realized the dividends all those years of suffering and struggling have paid. Starting from zero meant I had nothing to lose. More important, though, having no options kept me focused in a way that would have been impossible otherwise. There was no plan B for me. I didn't have the luxury of a fallback career. My only choice was to keep plugging away even as I failed and failed and failed. But I didn't just fail. I also kept notes. I learned from my mistakes. And I kept my head in the game. As my stepdad used to say to me when I was in my teens, you can't catch a fish if your hook isn't in the water. And I kept my freaking hook in the water all the time. Even until this day, my hook is never coming out of the water. John Mayer, the artist, recently told me that he figured out the world was bendable when he was around 19 years old. Although I had never used this fascinating term for the experience he was describing, I knew exactly what he was talking about. I didn't discover that I could move around in a world freely until my early 20s. Around that time, I graduated from college. I realized that it wasn't just me who felt insecure and at times defeated. Most people didn't know what they were doing either. They were also figuring it out as they went. And that's nothing to be ashamed of. If I just showed confidence in a direction I'd chosen, false confidence or not, that was good enough. I didn't need to have any special knowledge or power to give something I wanted to try a shot. I just needed to do it. And there's a lot of freedom in that line of thinking. I believe, with all my heart, that if you want something bad enough, with the right life choices and work ethic, you can get it. Unless it's physically impossible to attain. So, don't hit me with the, I want to dunk a basketball, but I'm an overweight 5'3". That's not going to happen for you, dude. When you're starting out, not at home plate, but outside the ballpark. I didn't come from the toughest background of all time. I understand. I had privileges others didn't. I met a guy a couple months ago who had been homeless all the way through high school. Still, he graduated, went on to college, and even earned an advanced degree. So when I say the privileged have it easier, we're all a little more privileged than someone else. It doesn't just go one way. The reason I talk about where I come from is because I come from the same type of background that a lot of America comes from. Small town, week-to-week paycheck, some sort of not-so-pleasant family situation that may or may not include a lot of illegal substances. You may be a rich kid who had a terrible family situation. We all have our baggage. I'm not the only one. Mine's bad. Others have it worse. Who's capable of judging on that kind of scale? I used to build seawalls, one of the many jobs I've done. You'll hear more about that later. And the worst part was carrying these large white buckets of wet concrete up the hill. They'd bruise your legs, hurt your hands, and there was always another waiting for you at the bottom of the hill. We all have our different buckets of concrete. I know there are a lot of people out there who can relate to me. And it's for people who don't have anyone to say, not only do I know where you come from, but you can do this. That's why I'm writing this book. When you're coming from less, and there are a lot of us, you have to give more to get equal to the rest of the world. It's not fair, but the fact that we have to fight our way to the top makes us so much stronger when we get there. By the way, how counterintuitive is that? When we start from worse, it makes us better. But it's a real advantage if we use it the right way. Failing upward. If we look at some of the most successful people in our culture, you'd be surprised at how much they failed. I could give you a million examples because I've studied this, but here are a few striking ones. Walt Disney. Yep, Walt Disney, one of the most creative and innovative minds of the 20th century. He created freaking Mickey Mouse. He dreamed up Disney World. He produced over 600 animated movies. No way he ever sucked, right? Wrong. He was fired from a local newspaper because he lacked creativity. Can you believe that someone thought this dude lacked creativity? That's like me getting fired because I don't have enough B's in my name. Also, his first business went bankrupt. He was told his little mouse was a terrible idea because it would terrify women. More than 300 people turned down investing in his crazy theme park about that same terrifying mouse. But Walt believed, and now there's not a person on the globe who doesn't know the name Disney, because he kept on. That terrible idea turned into a global, multi-billion dollar corporation of parks, resorts, broadcast, cable, radio stations, a killer movie studio, toys, apps, clothing, and I think his head is still frozen somewhere, regardless of what anyone says. Okay, well, so maybe not all of Walt's ideas were winners, like the head thing, but you get the point, right? Steve Jobs. Whenever you read articles or books that talk about the co-founder of Apple, they always bring up that he, like Bill Gates, dropped out of college and still became one of the most successful people in the universe. But that was just one of his failures. The man who basically created the way we talk to each other now through technologies like the iPhone and the iPad had a whole bunch of massive product failures with that company that he started in his garage. Even after he became a success, he was fired as an executive from the company that he created. People took many things away from the famous biography of him that was written by Walter Isaacson. If you haven't read it, I encourage you to read it. It's fantastic. Some of the things people took away was that he was controlling, that he had a big ego. What I saw was a guy who people considered nuts and who still wouldn't give up when it came to his vision. I hope to be considered as crazy one day. Stephen King. Writers, like actors, are famous for getting rejected. It goes with the territory. But the best-selling horror writer took rejection to a whole other level. He said, quote, "By the time I was 14, the nail in my wall would no longer support the weight of the rejection slips impaled upon it." He wrote that in On Writing, a memoir of the craft. He also said, "I replaced the nail with a spike and just went on writing." Still, when his first book, Carrie, was rejected by 30 publishers. Yeah, that's right. Carrie was rejected by 30 publishers. He got discouraged. You can't blame him for throwing the manuscript in the trash, which is what he did. And luckily for him, his wife fished it out of the trash and said, "Give it one last shot." Well, I guess the 31st time was the charm because it was accepted and became a runaway bestseller. Since then, he sold more than 350 million copies of his books worldwide, many of which have been made into movies that scare the crap out of kids everywhere. And by kids, I also mean adult men in their 30s who wear dark rim glasses and are talking to you now. Elvis Presley. Let's talk about Elvis for a second. We know him pretty much as the first great American solo artist. But when he went to the Grand Ole Opry, they basically said, "Dude, don't come back. You can't sing." They advised him to go back to being a grave digger, which is what he had been doing to make money. He couldn't even get into an a cappella group, and nobody likes a cappella, except Pentatonix. Hey, Pentatonix, if you're listening, you're cool. So I wrote a poem. It's called Ode to failure. And I actually delivered this at TEDx in Nashville. And that's the whole reason this book is written. You know, I mentioned earlier, I didn't want to write a second book. I wasn't going to write a second book. And I did this talk called Winning by Losing at TEDx in Nashville. And this is the poem that finished it out. You can find it on YouTube. Here you go. Even Disney got fired. The opposite of winning. Now we love that cartoon couple, Mickey Mouse and Minnie. Honest Abe failed at business. How much lower can you get? He dusted it off, got up again, became our 16th president. Do you know how many jobs Steve was fired from? Now we're all swiping apples so much it hurts our thumbs. Oprah was let go as a reporter at the age of 23. Oprah Winfrey in the daytime, highest paid host on TV. The Beatles were turned down by some record label jerk. You tell McCartney or Lennon that his music wouldn't work. And I don't stand here before you as the picture of success. I just got real good at losing and held out longer than the rest. Listen, the pattern is real. The people who make it are the ones that don't quit. They are borderline crazy about what they're trying to achieve. They fail, but they don't quit. That's been true in my life as well. Out of the 30 radio jobs that I applied to in my career, I got 3 of them. And 30 is a low estimate. Those are the ones that I can remember not getting. Still, 1 and 10, that's a lot of freaking rejection. Sometimes a formal rejection was the best thing that could happen. You want to feel like you really suck? Send a full package, your resume, tapes, the full thing, and here, nothing back. Not even the crickets to keep you company. That happened to me more times than I was even told no. I wanted a job so badly that one time I placed a tape of my radio show, my resume, and my picture in a pizza box. Then I put on some khakis and a button-up shirt to deliver the pizza box to the station myself. I figured if the program director thought it was pizza, he would open it up and then take note of my ability to go the extra mile creatively. I walked into the station and the program director was in the reception area. Jackpot! This is for Peter Cottontail, I announced. Not his real name. I don't want to say his real name, but you get it. Freaking Peter Cottontail opened the box, excitedly looked inside, and then mumbled, "This isn't even pizza. This is an effing demo tape." And then he threw it in the garbage. Needless to say, I moonwalked out of the place and did the old nothing to see whistle as I backed out of there and got far away. Do I enjoy bombing out? No, of course not. But I've learned far more from my failures than I have my successes. It's almost a feather in the cap type thing. When you mess up, you can figure out what went wrong, because then hopefully you won't make the same mistake again. The next time, I sent a pizza with the demo tape. Boom. Still didn't get the job, though. It's like the baby that touches the stove. Most babies don't give that stove a second grab. I try not to give bonehead moves a second grab, and rarely a third. And if you keep making the same mistake over and over again, it's time to call a shrink, because there's some hidden cog in your brain that's sabotaging your best interests, and you got to work that crap out. For example, every relationship I've ever been in. University of Alabama head football coach Nick Saban once said, "I don't want to waste a failure." That struck me. Every failure is some kind of opportunity in disguise. In fact, I'm only writing this book because I failed at pitching a children's book. True story. I went from publisher's office to publisher's office, selling my idea for a kid's book, except no one was buying. Finally, someone, my wonderful publisher now, by the way, decided that I should do a kid's book later. By the way, I'm still waiting. And I should begin my career as an author with a motivational memoir instead. I was petrified to write the thing. And frankly, at first, I just did not think it was very good. I wasn't sure if my stories were relatable, inspirational, or at all entertaining to anyone. Particularly smart folks like you who buy books and listen to me talk to you through audiobooks. Smash cut to my first book making the New York Times bestseller list. And it never would have happened if I hadn't failed at writing a children's book. It's unbelievable looking back at the turn of events that led to Bare Bones and also all the awesome people that I met in the process. Turns out readers not only sympathized, but mostly empathized with my stories. My whole perspective on my own life story changed because I failed. Fail, learn, repeat. Fail, learn, repeat. Keep failing until you don't. So you don't believe me? I get it. I'm just a radio dork, barely decent comedian, mediocre musician. Why would you take my word for it? Now I'm about to get all smart on you and reference something pretty amazing. How about a Stanford professor and one of the world's leading researchers in the area of motivation who has spent her life studying the secret to success? You want to believe her? After decades of researching how people achieve, psychology professor Carol Dweck discovered a simple but revolutionary concept that she calls mindset. Basically, she breaks mindset into two different types, fixed and growth. Those who have a fixed mindset think that their ability and intelligence are fixed and that talent is the biggest predictor of success. If you have a growth mindset, on the other hand, you believe you can improve any of your natural skills through dedication and hard work. As the good professor writes, brains and talent don't bring success. They can stand in the way of it. That's really something coming from a lady who's taught at Harvard, which is ground zero for brains. But I get what she's saying. Knowing you can improve is a highly undervalued form of intelligence. Some of the smartest people I knew in high school and college struggled hard. But the folks who always worked their faces off all along are still doing fine. There's no genius in effort. There's no genius in fortitude. I've found that the most successful self-made people are those who are great at chasing an idea hard, screwing it up, learning from it, and getting right back into the chase. It's about keeping up the hustle. I love the hustle. Dweck is a huge fan of effort, arguing that you can always improve no matter where you're starting from, and that mindset, quote, creates a love of learning and resilience essential for great accomplishment. Virtually all great people have had these qualities. In her book, Mindset, The New Psychology of Success, she shares how her research began with the desire to figure out how people deal with failure. She created a study where kids were presented with puzzles that got increasingly harder. Now, some of the kids just gave up, while others embraced the challenge and got psyched on the struggle so they could get better at doing puzzles. She said, quote, I always thought you coped with failure or you didn't. She also said, I never thought anyone loved failure. Were these alien children or were they onto something? It seems that the kids were onto something, and so was Dweck, by the way. Her theory has had wide-ranging implications for the fields of business and sports and education. Dweck said, failure is information. She said, we label it as failure, but it's more like, well, this didn't work, and I'm a problem solver, so I'll try something else. She told that to Forbes. And that's awesome, because for people like me, your buddy Bobby here, that gives failures like me some real hope. And as long as we can find the resilience to bounce back from defeat and the consciousness to learn from it, we can achieve whatever you define success is. According to people who study this stuff, a lot of it depends on your attitude toward whatever you find hard. If you think you're a loser because you didn't get math, the girl, or the job, you're probably going to have an even harder time making a go of it next time, if there's even a next time. But if you can flip that idea of rejection on its head and turn it into a chance to improve your algebra or your pickup lines, then you aren't stuck at the bottom of the heap, but at the beginning of a long, optimistic hike up the mountain. If failure is information, according to Dweck, I got a huge data dump on me during my network TV debut when I was tasked with interviewing Jason Aldean on the award show. The plan was for Jason, who's a chart-topping singer, by the way, to talk to me, and we were going to talk for 2 minutes. By the way, that's an eternity for live TV or radio or anything. As an experiment, look into your mirror and just try to talk for 2 minutes. Then come back to listening to this and you may have a little more empathy for this next story. So with microphone in hand and a ton of questions and witty comments in my head, I waited backstage with Jason for our cue to start. Moments before we were set to take the stage, a producer yelled, "We have 15 seconds, not 2 minutes." 15 seconds? That was hardly enough time for me to say, Jason Aldean. This was no longer an interview, but an intro. Before I could process the information, the producer had counted me down, and I was on stage. Away I went! And by away I went, I mean I screamed like a parrot. If I could play for you how it sounded, it would go like this. Jason Aldean's next! And then the camera shut off. Someone grabbed my mic and I was led to my seat. You can always tell when you don't do a good job because no one wants to talk to you afterward. Sometimes people will talk to you, but not about the presentation you just gave in the office or your performance in a community theater production, but about something totally random instead. So while I walked back to my seat, a friend said, "Man, your jacket looked great on camera." He might as well have said, "You sucked, and I need something else to compliment you on because otherwise I'm going to feel really awkward." No one would have blamed me if I chose to ignore the whole embarrassing moment where I choked on national TV. Instead, when I was back on the radio Monday, I played my parrot imitation over and over and over again. Everyone laughed, which is always the aim of my morning show. But I was doing something for myself. By repeatedly exposing my screw-ups, no matter how painful, I minimize the chance of repeating them. I promise you, I'll never sound like a wounded chicken on national TV again. So this section's called My Biggest Failure, and I've asked a bunch of my friends to come in and write about their biggest failures, which you don't know about probably, because they're known as massive successes. My Biggest Failure by Andy Roddick. I don't want you thinking I'm the only one who fails big time. So I asked my friends in sports, entertainment, and media to share their biggest failures, and first up is Andy Roddick. He also happened to be one of the top tennis players in the world before he retired in 2012. He's an athlete with heart, having established the Andy Roddick Foundation, which, since 2001, has raised more than $10 million to provide education and sports-based mentoring to low-income youth. Whether on the court or advocating for kids, Andy's a true fighter. As Tennis Magazine described Andy, he kept working, kept searching for new ways to win, kept listening to new voices, and kept himself near the top of the game. So this is from Andy here. He says, "My biggest failure is not winning Wimbledon. I lost to Roger Federer in three finals, and for better or worse, that defeat defines me to most of the public. I've been the number one ranked tennis player in the world, won the U.S. Open, finished in the top 10 of ATP's rankings for 9 straight years. But the only thing that people want to talk about at Starbucks is that match with Roger. While I still have moments where I feel pretty sick to my stomach when I think of how close I was to beating the greatest ever in a Wimbledon final, that match completely changed my relationship with tennis fans for the better. Viewing me through a different lens, they began to always pull for me, say hello, or tell me where they were for that match. I went from a temperamental, polarizing, arrogant, sometimes misunderstood figure by my own doing to simply Andy. Press was easier. Public practices were more fun. I was now flawed and relatable. My biggest failure created thousands of these many moments, simple interactions that meant so much to me. I don't know if I would have appreciated that kind of human attention if I had won the match. I might have taken self-absorption to another level. Who knows? I love where I'm at now, and I wouldn't be here if I hadn't lost at Wimbledon." What this book is not about. So life is weird, or maybe better put, frustrating. Or how about this? Unfair. 100 right decisions might not make you a success, but one really bad decision can ruin you. I was at the gym today, and a guy there started talking to me about his brother who had crashed into a tree because he was driving drunk. Now he's in the hospital on a ventilator. Doctors aren't sure if he's going to make it. The guy naturally was upset because of his brother's condition, but he was also surprised that his brother had been drinking and driving. He had never known him to drink that much, let alone get in a car drunk. The only thing he could be thankful for was that his brother didn't hit anyone else. Now listen, I don't drink. I never have. My parents' own struggles with booze have pretty much scared me straight, but I could still relate to the scenario. That one decision to drink and get behind the wheel, which may change the course of his life forever if he lives, probably all came down to a single moment of, at best, not thinking clearly. And at worst, making a stupid choice. So I want to make a very clear distinction between failure and screwing up. Failure is when you're working toward a positive goal and you either have a setback or have to start from square one. Screwing up is when you're not thinking or when you're making excuses for why something's okay when you know it really isn't. This has nothing to do with risk. Sometimes you have to take risks. I've taken many, but they're all calculated. There's a big difference between calculated risk and risky behavior. Risk is what billionaire hedge fund managers assess before making a stock trade. Risky behavior is what teenagers do in the back of a parked car. Rewards are much harder to come by than consequences. It's not a fair fight, but fair is a fairy tale anyway. Don't let that be your excuse to throw it all away with one stupid choice. Keep fighting, and you'll get there in one piece. How to do this thing, or at least my way of doing it. I'm fully aware that it's easier to type these words than to actually do what they spell out. When you get divorced or get let go from your job, it feels like crap. In those moments, it's hard to find a positive takeaway. I do a lot of speaking, especially at schools. Whenever I do, the kids ask some version of the question, "Hey, how do I become successful?" It's such a big idea that it's almost meaningless. Except that it's the most meaningful question in the world. They're asking me what we all want to know. Am I going to do something with my life? Am I going to matter? Am I going to be all right? And I wish I had an answer that made life easier, because if I did, I would use it for myself. I'm still working and learning about myself all the time. I think about my revelation after recently meeting my dad. As we were walking out of the barbecue place, I thanked him again for taking off work and meeting with me. "You're welcome," he said. He turned, he looked me in the eye. "It was weird having a day off," he said. "You don't have many days off?" I asked him. Hardly ever. I end up thinking about sad beep too much. And in that moment, I actually saw a mirror of myself and realized that the man I had turned into a supervillain was just flawed and vulnerable. Just like me. Just like most of us. Unless you're a sociopath or Tim Tebow, basically, we're all the same. Normal freaking humans. When I put myself in my dad's position, he was 16 in a bad place when he had me. I had more compassion for who he was and the decisions that he had made in life. There are no easy answers, and that's kind of the point. I want people to feel better about the struggle. So when those kids in the auditorium ask me how to be successful, I ask them the same thing that I'll ask in this book. Can you fight, grind, and repeat? Fight, grind, repeat. That isn't just something that I say in my speeches at school. I say it over and over again on the radio. I say it to myself. I have these words written on the wall at home, or on many of my workout shirts, or my chair at work. By the way, thanks Garth Brooks for that chair. I even have them tattooed on my scrotum. Okay, that last one's a lie. I'm not that tough, but still, you get it. This phrase is such a huge part of my identity, people often ask me how I came up with it. And here's what I can tell you. It wasn't something that I gave a whole lot of thought. Once I get past stage one of thinking, I start to overthink. And that's when things get murky and I usually land in trouble. Fight, grind, repeat was born one day after I'd worked 53 days in a row doing radio shows, comedy sets, shows with my band, and a few TV appearances. I was exhausted, I mean really exhausted, and I'm someone who wakes up every morning at 3 a.m. for work, so that says something if I'm really exhausted then. To get through the last few days of my grueling stretch, I just needed something to hang on to, something to say. I needed a reminder as to why I was doing all of this. There's nothing like a half-empty theater where the few people who are there aren't laughing at your jokes to make you want to call it quits for good, especially if you're running on 3 hours of sleep a night. Fight, grind, repeat. Those three simple words were enough to shift my psychological state from defeat to, if not victory, at least the will to stay in the game. Fight, because every day is a fight, in some form. It could be a fight from within to push yourself to a new limit, or it could be against one of the many people in the world who want to tell you no. Grind. The thing is, when a fight starts out, there's a lot of adrenaline, but that's quickly drained. And what you're left with is technique and stamina. This is the everyday stuff that's not cool or interesting, and it's not all that brave. It's waking up at 3 a.m. so you're never late, if you're me. Or sitting down to fill one of those college applications out, because they're tedious. You know, the little details of working toward what will most likely be failure, at least for a while. That's the grind. This is where it gets hard. Repeat. Now take the fight and the grind, which is the failure, and then do it again, and again, and again. The repeat is truly the only way to separate yourself from the pack. And it's where it gets really hard. It's also where you will find your true success. I'm going to tell you lots of stories about me being really crappy at things until I wasn't anymore. To add variety, I'm also going to share some stories about some cool and influential people such as Charles Esten, from Nashville, the TV show, and many other things. Walker Hayes, the musical artist, and these stories will be from before they were even cool.